everybody. This is Natalia Hernandez from the radio studio at the UMH, and you're listening to A Tall Mountain. I'm a teacher of English at the Official School of Languages in Elche, and this podcast has been born of the collaboration between the Official School's Media Center and the UMH, Universidad Miguel Hernández. You can listen to us on UMH Radio, but remember, you can listen to it whenever you want on iVoox, and also on the websites of the Official School of Languages and the UMH. Welcome to our 15th episode, which is going to be special. We're going to talk about something that, if we think about it carefully, has been happening before our eyes for centuries. The way society has called women crazy for daring to think, to write, to imagine worlds different from the one they had been assigned. Before we begin, I'd like us to do a small exercise together. Close your eyes for a moment and think of the word hysterical. What image comes to mind? Probably a woman. A woman who cries too much, who screams too much, who feels too much. A woman who, in reality, is simply too inconvenient. That word, hysteria, comes from the Greek hystera, meaning uterus. For centuries, doctors believed that women's intense emotional states originated in the uterus. If a woman was sad, anxious, if she didn't want to get married, if she wanted to read or write instead of doing those things women were supposed to do, it was because her uterus was disturbing her. The diagnosis was simple, and so was the solution. Confinement, silence, rest. No thinking, no creating. What we're going to explore today is how that system, which was not medicine but control, directly affected some of the most important writers in English language literature. Women who were institutionalized, medicated, silenced, and who, despite everything, wrote. Or perhaps precisely because writing was the only thing no one could ever fully take from them. Because there is something the patriarchy has never been able to understand. That the pen can survive the asylum. That poems can be born from the walls of a locked room. That the madness that frightened them so much was, in many cases, simply these women's refusal to live half a life. Today we're going to talk about five of them. Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton and Emily Dickinson. Charlotte Perkins Gilman was born in Hartford, Connecticut, in 1860, and what happened to her was not an accident or an individual tragedy. It was a system functioning exactly as it was designed to function. After the birth of her daughter, Charlotte suffered postpartum depression. She then was subjected to the controversial rest cure by the most famous physician of the era for such cases, Dr. Silas Weir Mitchell, a specialist in what they called female nervous diseases. His diagnosis was swift and decisive, hysteria. And this treatment, the so-called rest cure, included bed, silence, no reading, no writing, no thinking. And he told her never to touch a pencil again for the rest of her life. Charlotte complied for a time, and she nearly went mad, until she decided to disobey. She began writing again, and in 1892 she published The Yellow Wallpaper, a short story about a woman confined by her doctor and her husband in a room with yellow wallpaper, who gradually loses her mind precisely because of that confinement. It's one of the most important feminist texts in the history of literature. A story that describes with surgical precision how the patriarchy transforms health into illness and imprisonment into treatment. Charlotte Perkins Gilman even sent the text to Dr. Mitchell in the hope that he would acknowledge his error. Apparently, he modified his method of treatment after reading it, which means that a work of fiction accomplished what nobody had been able to say to his face. Virginia Woolf was born in London in 1882 into an intellectual and privileged family. But privilege, as we know, has never protected women from the system. From a young age, Virginia was diagnosed with what then was called melancholia, and later defined by some as bipolar disorder. She suffered episodes of deep depression, hallucinations, and several suicide attempts. On multiple occasions, she was subjected to what was called complete rest, confinement at home without books, without writing, without intellectual life, as though the problem were thinking itself. The irony and the tragedy is that writing was precisely what kept her afloat and what allowed her to build one of the most innovative bodies of work of the 20th century. Woolf didn't only write novels, she wrote essays that are now foundational texts of literary feminism. In A Room of One's Own, published in 1929, she articulated something that sounds simple, but was then radical. To write, a woman needs money and a space of her own. She needs, in short, what men were given without question. Her novels, Mrs. Dalloway, The Waves, To the Lighthouse, explore the human mind with a delicacy and depth that still leave us speechless today. Running through all of them is the constant question of what it means to be well, what it means to be broken, and who decides where the boundary lies. Virginia Woolf took her own life in 1941, at the age of 59. Walking toward the River Ouse with her pockets full of stones. If there is one writer whose name has become synonymous with female madness in popular culture, it is Sylvia Plath. She was born in Boston in 1932. She was a brilliant student, a precocious writer, a woman who, from a very young age, wanted to devour the whole world. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and at the age of 20 she suffered a crisis that led to a suicide attempt and a hospitalization where she received electroconvulsive therapy, a treatment she described as one of the most terrifying experiences of her life. From that experience came The Bell Jar, her only novel, published in 1963 under the pseudonym Victoria Lucas, because at that time, a woman who wrote about madness, abortions, and the emptiness of marriage could not sign her own name without consequences. The novel is a devastating portrait of how 1950s society crushed young women. The options available to them were to become perfect wives, or to be declared insane. There was no middle ground. Sylvia Plath died by suicide in February 1963 at the age of 30, barely a month after the novel was published. She had two young children. She also had a body of poetry that would take decades to receive the recognition it deserved. Today, her collection, Ariel, is considered one of the most important poetry books of the 20th century. Her voice remains uncomfortable, precise, impossible to ignore. Anne Sexton was born in Newton, Massachusetts, in 1928. She was a housewife, mother of two daughters, wife of a businessman. Everything exactly as it was supposed to be. And yet, something didn't fit, or rather, everything fit too well. After the birth of her first daughter, Anne suffered a postpartum depression that led to a nervous breakdown. She was admitted to Westwood Lodge Neuropsychiatric Hospital, to which she would return repeatedly throughout her life. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and struggled with mental illness throughout her entire adult life, combining it with a blazing literary career that many of her critics would never have expected from her. Because Anne Sexton became a poet thanks to, or despite, her psychiatrist, who suggested writing as a way of processing her experiences. What no one expected was that she would do it so well, and with such courage. Her first poetry collection, To Bedlam and Part Way Back, published in 1960, spoke openly about madness, about psychiatric institutionalization, about electroshock. At a time when those subjects were absolutely unspeakable in poetry, especially for a woman. In 1967, she won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for her collection Live or Die. She was a university professor, admired, celebrated, and she continued to suffer. Anne Sexton died by suicide in 1974 at the age of 45. What she left behind is a body of work that opened doors that have never since been closed. The possibility of speaking in poetry about menstruation, abortion, male violence, madness, everything that was never supposed to be named. Five women. Five different ways the system tried to silence what it did not understand or what made it uncomfortable. What seems most important to remember is that the label of crazy was never neutral. It was a tool of control. It served to discredit, to confine, to prevent women from occupying the intellectual and public space that was rightfully theirs. When a woman was too intelligent, too independent, too rebellious, too sad, too much of anything, the diagnosis was right there, ready to be applied. That does not mean these women did not suffer. They suffered deeply. But their suffering was real, and it was also amplified, prolonged, and sometimes directly caused by a system that did not know what to do with them and decided that the simplest solution was to lock them away. The next time someone uses the word hysterical or unhinged or intense, think of them, of Virginia walking toward the river, Sylvia with the poems no one wanted to publish, Charlotte told never to pick up a pencil again, of Anne turning electroshock into metaphor, of Emily sewing her notebooks in silence. They wrote anyway. We're still reading them. And that, perhaps, is the most powerful form of resistance there is. It's now time for our next section, On Screen. I'll leave you the link to the short film The Yellow Wallpaper that you can watch online for free on YouTube. You shouldn't miss it. On YouTube too, you can watch a short documentary called Emily Dickinson, Why Did She Hide from the World?, in which a professor of psychiatry explores her life and tries to unravel the complex reasons why she hid herself away for over 20 years and published only 10 of 1,800 poems during her lifetime. You may have seen how Gwyneth Paltrow portrayed Plath in the biopic Sylvia, 2003. Elizabeth Sigmund, who was friends with both Plath and Hughes, criticized the movie for depicting Sylvia as a permanent, depressive and possessive person. But she conceded that the film has an atmosphere towards the end of her life, which is heartbreaking in its accuracy. To finish this section, let me mention that the great singer Peter Gabriel dedicated his song Mercy Street, which he named for her play Mercy Street, and which was inspired by his reading of her poem 45 Mercy Street. Listen to it. And now, before we go, I'm going to read Legacy to you, the poem by Rupi Kaur that inspired the name of this podcast. I stand on the sacrifices of a million women before me, thinking, what can I do to make this mountain taller so the women after me can see farther? Thank you for being here with me, everybody, for making this mountain taller. And that was all for today, and for this season too. We'll try to be back, if the stars align, next October. Don't forget that you can find the link to this podcast, as well as the links I talked about on the section on screen, posted on the Instagram page of the official School of Languages and on iVoox. Please subscribe. It will also be available on the school's website and on radio.umh.es. Thanks for listening to us. And also a huge thank you to the entire staff of UMH Radio. In the technical team today, Manuel Macia. Bye.